Welcome to a very special episode of Wrongful Conviction, in which we're trying something new. I've asked a previous guest to take on my usual role as interviewer. You might remember Patrick Persley from his own episode of Wrongful Conviction. Patrick did what seemed to be the impossible to win his freedom. He got a law changed from inside prison to allow for the post-conviction ballistics testing that proved his innocence. Just an amazing feat accomplished by a truly amazing guy. And now he brings us an interview with another innocent man who he knew while inside Illinois' Stateville Penitentiary, Jacques Rivera.
On August 27, 1988, a 16-year-old named Felix Valentin was shot in his car on the west side of Chicago. At the hospital, responding officers spoke with the victim who identified the shooter and getaway driver as members of the Imperial Gangsters. However, a corrupt detective named Renaldo Guevara instead targeted Jacques Rivera, a member of a different gang, the Latin Kings. Jacques ran a local recreation center that Guevara often targeted for information. Despite the victim's dying declaration to responding officers, Guevara claimed to have gotten a different identification during the 18 days before the victim's death. Guevara then misled an 11-year-old eyewitness to corroborate that bogus identification, charging Jacques with the murder. Jacques was tried under Judge Michael Close, who had recently been the focus of Operation Greylord, one of the biggest judicial corruption investigations in United States history. The judge wouldn't allow the testimony of the victim's original identification, and with the false testimonies of Guevara and the misled child witness, Judge Close convicted and sentenced Jacques Rivera to 80 years. When the Center on Wrongful Convictions took on Jacques' case, they found the eyewitness, now an adult, who greeted them with relief, saying that he had been waiting to tell the truth for the last 23 years. Since, an investigation into Guevara's corruption has resulted in the exoneration of over 20 innocent men and women, costing Chicago over $50 million and counting. This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome to Wrongful Conviction. This is Patrick Persley, also known as Free Patrick Persley. I was previously a guest on Wrongful Conviction, but today I'm honored to fill in for Jason Flom. We have a very special guest with us, a friend of mine, someone I knew a long time while in Stateville serving my own wrongful conviction, Mr. Jacques Rivera. How are you, sir?
Oh, Patrick, I'm good, man. I am really good.
So I want to thank you for having the trust in me to tell your story on behalf of Jason Flom. I know it's hard telling our stories, putting our pain out there on the line. Could you explain to the audience a little bit about yourself and just our connection?
Oh, well, our connection, unfortunately, being in prison together, you know, you was a great dude. Unfortunately for us, we were wrongfully convicted, so that doesn't change our character of who we were before we went in there. We didn't let it change who we were.
No, we didn't. And I appreciate that, Jax. Your case is, well, you know, you kind of hit the double reverse jackpot here. You have one of the most corrupt detectives in Chicago history, which is saying a lot. And his name is Detective Renaldo Guevara, real infamous guy. He's responsible for so many wrongful convictions, over 20 accounting. It's cost the city of Chicago over $50 million. And I can just tell you, as a jailhouse lawyer from Stateville, you know, my 23 years doing cases down there, his name came up again and again. And there was definitely a pattern present throughout. And then on top of that, you got a judge who's a person interested in investigation, judicial corruption in the 80s called Operation Greylord. That investigation was meant to root out pay-for-play scandal in which judges were accepting bribes, where basically they were fixing everything from parking tickets to murders. The judge in your case, Michael Close, was alleged to have taken $25,000 to fix a murder case, find one defendant not guilty and the other defendant guilty, I believe. While Judge Michael Close was never criminally prosecuted, he was pursued in civil suits. And the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, they represented him. And basically, their position was that he was immune from civil litigation during the commission of his judicial duties. So therefore, he was immune from civil liability, according to the law. So I think that says a lot about this case and where we're headed, and we haven't even started yet. But Jox, let's talk about your life. What was your life like growing up in the city of Chicago during this time?
Yeah, growing up on the northwest side of Chicago in the Humboldt Park area during the late 70s, all of the 80s, you know, really gang infested, high crime. And you had like four main gangs. There were the Imperial Gangsters, the Insane Spanish Cobras, the Maniac Land Disciples, and the Latin Kings. My dad had passed away when I was 15, and I had five other siblings that my mom had to take care of. And, you know, I was just roaming the streets. I was really distraught about my dad passing. He was kind of my rock, my guide. And, you know, didn't really have much of a choice but to join a gang. At that point, they offered protection. And without that protection, you'd be a target in the area. And we couldn't move out that area. So it wasn't like I wanted to do that or go down that path. I had no other choice. I was a member of the Latin Kings. So in Humboldt Park, they had a festival yearly. It was called the Fiesta Postanales. It's the celebration of the Latino culture. And there would be times where the gang violence was real bad in this festival time. So what the city decided to do along with the Puerto Rican Institute was to pay gang members to govern their own, you know, to stop the violence. So the gentleman from the Spanish Coalition suggested that we use this money to open up a community center, which was a great thing.
And just for people not familiar with Chicago, this was quite commonplace where the city paid the gangs to keep their guys in line. This was even done in prison. It was called Inmate Tenant Control Program. So this community center gets going over the years, gets a couple name changes, and I believe it's been named the Humboldt Park Institute. That's correct?
Yeah, that's when I really got involved in it. And it was doing so well that the city, they wanted to give us more money to open up a recreational center. They did, and we opened it up, and I was running it. It was called Mind and Body. We had weights in there, a foosball table, air hockey, games for the kids for after school programs. And people came in there a lot, adults and kids.
So it was considered like a safe place for a family.
Yeah.
Even though it's like in this so-called gang infrastructure, there was some good elements that came out of it.
Oh, yeah, definitely was. And that's where I think the troubles began. This detective, Rinaldo Guevara, he used to come in there from time to time looking for people. I was like, you know, we have nothing to hide here. It seemed like at first that he was just interested in how this program came about, who was involved in it, you know, who's in charge, who's running. I said, I am, and we're a part of the Humboldt Park Institute. And he used that as a means to come in there to look for people that he was looking for from the streets, the gang members, whether if it was to arrest them or just to talk to them or whatever it may be.
So now this brings us to the end of summer 1988, and the murder you got caught up in, it was a gang-related murder. And I remember you telling me it took someone to actually come into Stateville, laying it all out for you to actually know what was going on behind the scenes, what this actual beef was about. You had mentioned like multiple gangs operating this area. I believe it was Latin Kings, Maniac Latin Disciples, the Imperial Gangsters, Insane Spanish Cobras. What was going on at that time?
Those were the heavy hitters, if I can say that. And then you had these little block gangs, and the two of them were Insane Campbell Boys and Maniac Campbell Boys. And from what I understand was they were approached by the Spanish Cobras and the Imperial Gangsters. And they was telling them, you can either join us or we're going to shut you down.
A simulation.
Yeah. So I believe the Insane Campbell Boys went with the Insane Spanish Cobras, ISC. And the Maniac Campbell Boys, they said we were going to become Maniac Latin Disciples. So the Maniac Campbell Boys now were at war with the Imperial Gangsters about their decision about not riding with them, but going with the Maniac Latin Disciples.
And from what I understand, the victim in this case we're talking about today, 16-year-old Felix Valentin, he and his brother were Maniac Campbell Boys who were assimilated or basically had flipped into the Maniac Latin Disciples, who, like you said, they were now at war with the Imperial Gangsters over that fact. And that takes us to the day of the shooting, August 27, 1988.
Where Felix Valentin got shot was Imperial Gangsters neighborhood. He was over there with his brother. They were going to a wedding, and his brother went up the stairs, and he waited in the car, you know, like saying, hurry up, get up there, get out, because you know we ain't supposed to be in this area. So according to the police report and eyewitness report, a car drove up. pulled right behind Felix while he sat in the mouth of the alley. The passenger got out the car, walked up to Felix, and then this person opened fire on him. His brother heard the shots, came downstairs, ran to the car, saw his brother limped over, and he opened the car door, pushed his brother, Felix, over to the passenger side and took off to the hospital. There was a Chicago police officer that came on the scene. He went to the hospital, talked to the victim.
So this would be Officer Craig Lettrich. He was a responding officer. He also talked to people at the crime scene. So the next day, Felix Valentin stabilizes. Officer Lettrich went to the hospital, and Felix told Lettrich and his partner that it was the Imperial gangsters who had shot him, right?
Yes, sir. And he left the hospital, went back to the police station, and came back with an Imperial gangster mug book. And lo and behold, Felix Valentin identifies Jose Rodriguez and Philip Neves, and he didn't just identify them. He stipulated the participation that each of them took, and he said that Jose Rodriguez shot him and Philip Neves was driving the car.
So this should have been like an open and shut case, but that's not how this goes down. So even though Felix Valentin, the victim in this case, tells Officer Lettrich, the responding officers, who his attackers were, Detective Guevara led the investigation in a whole nother direction. Now, there's also a witness, an 11-year-old boy from the Imperial Gangsters neighborhood named Orlando Lopez, whose sister also happened to be dating Felix's brother and allegedly witnessed the shooting. And he allegedly said, because we're not even sure what he actually said, is might have been fed to him by Guevara, but he allegedly says he was standing at an indentation in the alley and saw the shooter from the back and described the shooter as about 5'10", dressed in black and gold. Now, those are Latin King colors, not Imperial gangster colors. What else was alleged?
He said that the car turned southbound on Spalding, which is in the direction of the Latin Kings, and was for certain that the shooter's hair in the back, he had a ponytail, and it was dyed like a blonde gold color.
And Guevara starts looking for marks to pin it on in Latin Kings territory, or maybe even had you in mind. So how did you do it? How did you get caught up in this?
Guevara came into the neighborhood. I was out there with the guys. He drove up on us and he said, I need to talk to you. What they used to do was use people as fillers in lineups. And I stood in a few lineups before. They just said, you know, don't worry about it. We know you didn't do it. We just need fillers. And Guevara drove up and he said, you know, we want to know if you're standing in a lineup. And I just knew it was funny because there's like 7 to 10 guys there and you picked me out of everybody.
Did you fit the description?
No, not at all. I mean, my hair was long in the back and never wore it in the ponytail, pigtail, none of that, or had it dyed that color or any color for that matter.
So Guevara approaches you and you feel kind of strange about this line of being a filler, but you did it before. So what's going through your mind as this is happening and what happened?
I said something was wrong. And when I hesitated, he opened up his coat and moved his coat from around his revolver as to say, you could come peacefully or you could come forcefully. I said, I know I didn't do nothing wrong. So I went with him. I was held in the police station for that day and the whole next day. And then on the third day, they put me in a lineup with Imperial gangsters. Why would you put me in a lineup with Imperial gangsters if it was the Lane Kings who did it?
Right. That's crazy. And Fernando Lopez is from the Imperial Gangsters territory. He probably knows all those guys. It looks a little bit like they might have been trying to lead the witness to pick someone that they didn't know. So were you identified at that time?
No, I was not identified. They let me go.
So that was your first lineup with this case, and they let you go. A little time passes, so you probably think the whole thing is behind you, it's blown over. But then at this time, if we could kind of see like a split screen behind the scenes, you're living your life, and these two other things are going on. First, Felix Valentin's health is rapidly going down. He now slips into a coma and eventually dies 18 days after the shooting on September 14th, 1988. Meanwhile, Guevara, he's working this Orlando Lopez kid, and it's believed that Guevara told Lopez that he had visited Felix in a hospital and Felix identified you. So then he starts pulling Orlando's heartstrings. Hey, this is your sister's boyfriend's little brother. That could have easily been you. So Guevara relates to Orlando, you know, The victim told him it was Jacques Rivera. Basically puts on this kid, like, what would you want someone to do for you in this particular situation? So now Rivera, he rolls up on you again.
Exactly. So I was at the Humboldt Park Institute, and I hear the screeching of a car, and it's Rivera and his partner, Halverson. And they said, hey, come here. And I went up to them. I put my hands up right away. He cuffed me up, and he says, what car are you driving? I said, a white Impala. So while Rivera went to search my car, I'm asking his partner, I said, man, what's going on, man? Y'all picked me up about 2 weeks ago. You asked me to stand in line. If I stand in line, I'm let go. He says, I don't know. This is Guevara's case. So Guevara came back. He sat me in the squad car and started proceeding to Area 5 police station. And I just kept hounding him. I was like, man, what's going on? They didn't buckle me in the back seat. So he stopped the car real quick. And as I flew forward, he grabbed me by my shirt. And he says, you being charged with murder, motherfucker. And he pushed me back. And he said, now shut the fuck up.
This episode is underwritten by AIG, a leading global insurance company. AIG is committed to corporate social responsibility and is making a positive difference in the lives of its employees and in the communities where we work and live. In light of the compelling need for pro bono legal assistance and in recognition of AIG's commitment to criminal and social justice reform, the AIG Pro Bono Program provides free legal services and other support to underrepresented communities and individuals.
We get to the police station. They put me in a lineup with Latin Kings. This was the second lineup. So I said, this time, I'm going to stand dead center to make sure whoever this witness is, so he can see me to know that this is not me. Another detective came in, and he made the noise like a gang show. Ding, 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 ding. He said, we got a winner. They identified you as the shooter. They removed the other gentleman that was in the lineup, and they said, did you want to talk about this? I said, there's nothing to talk about, man. I said, I don't even know what's going on. What do you want me to say? And then Guevara came up to me and goes, you know, you can make this easier on yourself. Tell us who the shooter was, and we're going to put you down for the driver, and we're going to help you out. I first thought to myself, not only do you want me to implicate myself in something that I didn't do, but you want me to implicate somebody else.
There was someone else under the bus, too.
And I told him, you got to be crazy, man. I'm not going to confess to something I didn't do or implicate nobody else. He's like, well, that's okay. You don't have to tell us nothing anyway because you're going down for this. And I was like, well, let the procedures begin.
So you're in Cook County Jail. I know the experience as far as getting locked up. Everything hits the fan. So can you describe that?
Honestly, it was just a horrific time, man. I had no contact with my family. My wife was there when he picked me up the second time. So she eventually got a lawyer that was a family lawyer to a friend of hers.
Now, leading up to the actual trial, did you take a jury or a bench trial?
I asked a few of my friends, and they're like, well, I'd rather have 12 people decide my fate instead of one person. Man, I would take a jury. I would take a jury. I would take a jury. So upon going back to court, my lawyer was like, have you come to a conclusion what you want to do? I was like, well, I think I want to take a jury. And he's like, oh, no. Listen. We're out here in Skokie. These people out here read and see on the news all day long about gang-related murders. He's like, I think we stand a better chance with this judge. He's a good judge. And not knowing the judge's background, being involved in the Gaylord operation, I was like, well, you're my attorney, man. I got confidence in you. So we took a bench trial.
Now, you mentioned Operation Gaylord, which is perhaps even more weighty as far as judicial import, even more important than this rogue detective Guevara. And for the listeners who don't know, Operation Gaylord was the largest corruption bust in United States history. Comes straight out Cook County, or should they say Crook County, Illinois. It led to an unprecedented number of indictments against public officials. It got 17 judges, 48 lawyers, 8 cops, 10 deputy sheriffs, 8 court officials, and one good old legislator. Can't leave him out. Your judge was one of the many judges investigated in this sting operation. The Honorable Judge Michael Close was alleged to have taken a bribe in a case not connected to this one. But nevertheless, it was still alleged that one of these two defendants fighting a murder case in front of Judge Close, Robert Bridges, paid $25,000 so that he would obtain a not guilty verdict in his bench trial. And his rappy John Cardellino, who also had Judge Close, would be conversely found guilty. So unbeknownst to you, Jock, you're having a bench trial So your whole life is placed in this judge's hands who's obviously morally compromised. So, Jack, what was presented against you? What did they actually use during the trial?
The prosecution put Orlando Lopez on the stand. He was primed up by Guevara to say that he saw a man from the back, about 5'10", wearing black and gold with a gold-dyed ponytail. He said that the man shot Felix and hopped into a getaway car that went down Spalding. When asked if he got a look at the shooter's face, he said that he only caught a glimpse of the shooter, always looking at the back of the shooter. When asked if he could point to the shooter in court today, he said it was me, and he pointed at me. I was going crazy at that moment, you know, in my mind, saying, "You're fucking lying, man. Why are you doing this? Why are you saying that this is me, and you know damn well I didn't do this shooting?" Then Guevara got on the stand and said that when he arrested me that I had a ponytail, which was dyed gold or blonde in the back, which, of course, it never was. And then Guevara said he visited the victim, Felix Valentin, in the hospital, maybe a couple of days, if not a week, before he died. And that he identified me as the shooter out of a photo lineup. My defense put on Officer Lettrich, who was the officer that was on the scene, who spoke to the victim. So upon Officer Lettrich getting on the stand, the state intervened and they had a sidebar. And Judge Close said, "I'm only going to allow competent evidence in." So he would not allow Officer Lettrich to testify that Felix Valentin, the victim, had said that Jose Rodriguez was the one who shot him, and Philip Nieves was the one that was driving the car. He was only allowed to say that he was on the scene and he visited the victim and he attempted to arrest two individuals in this case. And basically, that was it.
So if I'm understanding this, you're saying LaRich, who's got a dying declaration from the victim in the hospital of who shot him, for some reason, this is not competent or credible evidence in his eyes.
Exactly. I couldn't believe it. And then my alibi was the mother of my kids. So my attorney's telling me, "Well, they're going to say she's biased because she's the mother of your kids and that she would lie for you." The state tried to say that, well, if Mr. Rivera was actually at home with his wife at the time of the shooting, the defense would have put her on the stand. And my lawyer was like, "We object, Your Honor. We're not underneath no obligation to present a defense." I'm like, "Who in the hell told him that? You're supposed to represent me, you know?" And then my lawyer says, "Well, the state would have said she was biased anyways."
So you're found guilty. Bring us to that moment right then.
About the closing arguments, I actually thought that Judge Close was going to take some time and go back into his chambers and consider all the evidence and come back and give his decision. But right there on the stand, after the closing arguments, he said, "Well, I came to my conclusion and I find the defendant guilty." And I was like, "Wait a minute, man." You know, he didn't even take 10, 15 minutes. He just came straight on and said, "I find the defendant guilty." And I was just like, "Oh, my goodness." We went back for sentencing, and he gave me 60 years for the murder, for the shooting. He gave me 20 years for brutal and heinous. And then he gave me 5 for the UUW, the gun, which they never had. First of all, I was worried about my family, the mother of my kids, what was going to happen to them. But I knew at that point that I had to prepare for what I was going into. I wind up in Stateville Correctional Center, June of 90.
Right. I was actually there in 89. Yeah. So can you describe that? What is this like? What is this environment to you?
Well, the only thing that saved me was the gang that I rode with. They were already waiting for me to come in. They meet you downstairs while you're in the bullpen, and they go tell the sergeant, "Hey, this is one of ours. Put him up there with us."
Because the gangs at that time, they considered themselves owning the cells.
Exactly.
And the officers put the responsibility on the gang chiefs to keep the Indians in line and find them a cell.
So if I'm walking down 7 Gallery, I look down to 1 Gallery and I see this guy hit this officer with a baseball bat. Boom! And I went, "Oh my goodness." And they put me in a cell. It was an empty cell. And we went on a 90-day lockdown. In the middle of June, in 90, 95 degree weather, I had no soap, no shampoo. I had nothing. And then during the second month of being on the lockdown, they sent another king up there who was just coming in. And they put him in a cell with me. So we got along pretty good. We came off of lockdown. You know, we never even made it to the chow hall. Officers came up there, keyed us out. We came out the cells. and you hear the gun go off. Boom, boom.
Back on lockdown, homie.
Back on lockdown. 6 months of lockdown of first entering the prison system. And it was hell, pure hell.
Did you try to like study law? What was your mental process as far as how you were going to get out of there?
Well, I couldn't study nothing because we was on a lockdown. We couldn't go nowhere. Nobody really had any law books. Amazingly enough, before I left the county jail, somebody told me, listen, man, file for your notice of appeal because you only got 30 days to do this. So I filed it in the county jail. I was telling my wife, I was like, listen, I got all this time. Ain't no sense of you waiting around for me. You know, just move on with your life. She said, well, let's wait to see what happens to the appeal process. I got that dreaded letter. Sorry, Jacques, to inform you that the appellate court denied our petition today and blah, 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 blah. I think at that point, I started to lose hope.
And so now you're done with your direct appeal. Do you remember like what year this was?
95, 96, maybe.
So how did you first hear about Northwestern Center Wrongful Convictions? I know they get thousands of letters every year from inmates seeking representation. They represented me, but they had told me no 3 times prior. Do you know what made your case stand out to them?
Actually, it was Detective Guevara. After losing that direct appeal and knowing what was ahead of me, I got to start reaching out to people. In the law library in Stateville, they have a list of pro bono attorneys and law firms that would help with cases and stuff like that. So I wrote Northwestern, and Catherine Crawford was one of the attorneys there who contacted me and she goes, we're not taking your case. We're just investigating Detective Guevara, and we just want to ask you some questions. If we should happen to come upon something, then we'll be interested in taking the case. She stated that they were trying to find the eyewitness, which is Yolanda Lopez. She goes, you know, you have a good case, but you have a bad case. You got a good case because you was convicted on a single identification, no physical evidence, but it's a bad case because there's no evidence. There's nothing for us to go on other than this eyewitness, and we've been trying to locate him.
So then in 2010, with the advance of this search engine tech, Northwestern locates the only witness against you, Orlando Lopez. It's been 23 years since his false identification of you. So what happens next?
They went to his home, and he answered the door. And they give him their card and tell him who they was. He goes, I know who you're here for. You're here for Jacques Rivera. And according to their statement, he just kept saying, you know, this is all about redemption. And he says, first of all, I didn't even know if Jacques Rivera was still locked up. He goes, I don't even know what happened to the case. He needed to clear his conscience of this. And he's got 3 boys. He said he couldn't look at them in the face knowing that something like this can happen to them. They asked him about 1988, the Felix Valentin shooting. And he proceeded to say what transpired that day. And he just stated that he was there and he saw somebody. And Detective Rinaldo Guevara picked him up 2 days, maybe 3 days after the shooting. He was shown a lineup to identify somebody and he made no identification. And then he proceeded to say that a couple of days later, as he's walking to school, he sees the guy who actually shot and killed Felix Valentin. And he says he knows he's the guy because he had the same pants and jacket on. And he said to himself, this is the guy who did it. It wasn't Jacques Rivera. But he's 12 years old. He don't know what to do.
So Orlando knew what Felix knew, but none of this mattered to Detective Guevara. So how does he handle this 11-year-old kid, or mishandled, however you want to put it?
So now here we go with Detective Guevara telling him that this is the guy we believe who killed your sister's boyfriend's brother. And we need you to get this guy. We need to get him off the street so he doesn't kill nobody else. And Orlando Lopez is like, you don't understand. It's not him. He said, I seen the real guy. This is not the guy. So Guevara proceeds with saying, well, this is what Felix Valentin said. So Orlando Lopez, he says, they weren't listening to him. He said, well, if they're not going to listen to me. And this is his testimony. He said he proceeded to make the identification of me, knowing that it wasn't me.
So now the only witness in the case, Orlando Lopez, he recanted on record. You got Officer Letrick. He's standing by this original identification that Felix made prior to his passing. So all you really have to get around now is whether Felix had changed his story prior to passing and made a dying declaration to Guevara to somehow implicate you. That is, when and if he ever even spoke to Guevara.
So now my attorneys, they find the doctor that was taking care of Felix Valentin while he was sat in intensive care. the doctor said. It was impossible for Felix Valentin to identify anybody because at that stage, he had slipped into a coma. So Vera fabricated that whole line of procedure. And when my lawyers asked for that lineup, they said, well, where's these line of photos? Because when you make an identification of somebody, you put that into evidence. They could have produced the photos because it never took place.
So as this evidence is coming out, how is the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, how are they responding to these allegations?
Darren O'Brien, who was Assistant State's Attorney, he offers me a plea deal. My attorney came down to Stateville to see me. And she said, I know how you feel about this, but I still have to bring it to you. They offered you a plea deal. It's Wednesday. You can be home by Friday.
Now, you'd be surprised because a lot of people would jump on this. I know people personally have jumped on this. Myself, I wouldn't even have no talk of a plea bargain. Now, I've also seen the state's attorneys when they're about to lose one of these long, protracted court battles with someone locked up, start using continuance after continuance as almost like a weapon of choice. Not just to wear down the resolve and get you to take a plea deal, but even waive your right to file for a certificate of innocence and not come after them with any type of civil liability. So, you know, knowing like this is out their playbook, this is what they do. They try to wear you down. Were you tempted at all to take the plea deal?
Absolutely not, because my heart was for the victim's family. And that's the God honest truth. What price would I pay for my freedom? To admit to something that I didn't do? And to lie to this victim's family and tell them, yeah, I killed your son. Absolutely not. I said, I got 20 plus years left. If I have to go back to do this, I'd be more than happy to go back and do it with not only a clear conscience, but with a happy heart.
So from the time they brought you to plea deal, how much longer before you're actually in court on the hearing?
It was about 6 months. And then January of 2011, Judge Close retired and passed away. You know, the state attorney said, well, we're going to keep it here in Cook County. And they appointed me a judge, which was Nero Walsh, who just came out of the state's attorney's office. Orlando Lopez came in to testify, and his testimony was, what matters to me is that I'm here today to say that that man, and he pointed right at me, Jacques Rivera, was not the man who shot and killed Felix Valentin back in 1988. And I was like, hallelujah.
So Judge Nero Walsh ruled that Lopez's recantation was credible, stating that the only reason the court sees for this recantation now is a desire to correct a mistake. And she ordered a new trial for you. And then October 4, 2011, the Cook County prosecutors announced that they did not intend to proceed on new trial and dismiss all charges. And you were freed that day. Take me to that moment.
Oh, my goodness. I finally said, and it took this long to do all this. 23 years, man.
So you were awarded a certificate of innocence and you were awarded $208,000 in state compensation. And that same year, you filed a lawsuit against Chicago police, Detective Guevara and others for bearing evidence and pressuring witnesses to falsely identify you.
Yeah.
And June 2018, you were awarded over $17
million. Yes.
That is amazing. How do you look back on this?
I mean, for me, it's water under the bridge, although it does still affect me in some ways.
Right. You're 56 now. This is a long ordeal.
Yeah. And I'm just glad to be home with my friends, most importantly, my kids, which devastated our relationship, being away from them. My daughter, she was 6 months old. She don't even know who I am. But my boys, on the other hand, is different, but we still have issues. We're working at them, trying to be a family. I'm just grateful for it only because I don't really need nothing, Patrick. I try to help other people, and that's what I'm doing. I'm in restorative justice work now. I accept calls for guys from the prisons, anything they might need, try to hook them up with attorneys or put them involved with wrongful conviction centers. I just try to do my part. You know, I know that I left behind a lot of good brothers who are innocent and a lot of them who said they're guilty, but they have remorse. But I'm not going to leave them there just like that.
So if you could get the listeners to help out, to join in, what would you implore them to do?
There's so many wrongful conviction centers, the Exoneration Project, the Innocence Project in New York, the Center on Wrongful Convictions, the Blum Legal Clinic here in Chicago. Definitely could use some support. Some of it's finance, some of it's just volunteer work. So many innocence projects that could be supported. Need attorneys to volunteer their time, pro bono investigators, but help is always needed.
We'll have links in the bio, and now we'll go to the closing portion of our show. I want to thank the listeners. and I want to thank Jason Flom for having me. I want to keep the tradition going. I want to allow Jack Rivera to have the last word. So I'm going to turn my mic off, turn my headphones up, and let you just say your thing.
Don't ever give up hope, man. And that's not only dealing with wrongful convictions, that's dealing with everyday life. Our God is a great God, and he loves us and he cares about us. A lot of people don't realize that. I didn't realize that. I'm letting you know there is a God, and he delivered me from an 80-year sentence on a wrongful conviction. I'm a part of a program called Innocent Demand Justice. Just the families of loved ones who are incarcerated wrongfully, and we try to show support any way that we can, either by marches, protests, going to court hearings. We know how hard it is for loved ones. Anything could happen in prison, and they're scared for their loved ones. Yeah, don't ever give up hope. Keep hope alive.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Justin Golden, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis, with research by Lila Robinson. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all 3 platforms. You can also follow me on both TikTok and Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.